Good afternoon, Council. You're ready to proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the Court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell, and I'm here on behalf of Cedric McGriff, who was convicted in the Superior Court of various felony offenses, various felony sexual offenses, a number of years ago. This case was originally affirmed on direct appeal, and as a result of the decision of the United States Supreme Court in Crawford versus Washington, we filed a post-conviction relief motion on Mr. McGriff's behalf.
Do I understand in the briefs correctly to state that every court that's considered whether Crawford should apply prospectively or retroactively, except the Ninth Circuit, has decided it should be prospective?
That is close. There was a New York Supreme Court decision, which is their trial court, which also found that it was a watershed rule of criminal procedure and should be applied retroactively. It's cited in my briefing, in the reply brief, I think. But that...
And New Mexico in the Forbes case?
I don't recall that. I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. There have not been many, but we submit that's not because the rationale of those few cases is flawed. In fact, the United States Supreme Court thought it was important enough to consider this issue in Wharton versus Bochting, in which certiorari was accepted a few weeks ago, and it will be argued in the fall, the retroactivity, says, of Crawford.
What's your position on whether we should wait until that's determined by the United States Supreme Court, or we should decide this case in the interim?
Well, the court could wait because the court has...
I understand that. What's your position on whether we should or not?
If the court rules adversely to the defendant, I'll be back with another post-conviction relief motion. So probably that suggests...
You mean on a different subject?
Yes, the retroactivity of Wharton versus Bochting. That's the long and short of it. Judicial economy, I guess we could cite that. But on the other hand, there's another factor, precept, which looms here, which perhaps the court could decide it on, the Delaware Constitution. Now, I realize in Thomas versus State, the court has rejected our arguments regarding Delaware's child sex abuse law insofar as the violations of the right to confrontation. And however, we submit as a practical matter, as in this case, if the Delaware Constitution applies, can we picture this? Would a conviction have been under the Delaware Constitution, would a conviction have been upheld in 1997?
Well, that hasn't been briefed and argued in this case, has it?
No, it hasn't, but it's perhaps a reason to.
But our court has held that we're not going to decide anything under the Delaware Constitution that hasn't been fully briefed and argued, haven't we?
Then in that case, yes, the court has held that. However, I'd cite as an example, for instance, the state has brought to the court's attention the recent United States Supreme Court decision in Davis versus Washington and Hammonds versus Indiana. That case addresses what is testimony for purposes of confrontation. And it's an important case in that regard. And I'm grateful that the state brought it to the court's attention because we believe it is helpful to the defense. In that case, the Supreme Court makes some observations that testimony essentially involves a description of past facts, and that requires confrontation, whereas a description of current events, ongoing offense, excited utterances, etc., are not testimony. Is under Davis and Washington. And that is helpful to this case Because in this case, there was no question of spontaneous declarations, et cetera. It was all the complainant's description of past events to various persons who were determining, who were trying to determine what, in fact, this child was talking about. She was questioned at length by them, and it was as a result of Delaware's child sex abuse hearsay law, which we submit is would be unconstitutional if the court ever had to consider it, if the state ever proffered evidence under the statute after Crawford versus Washington, would be unconstitutional. But noteworthy in this case, for instance, you know, we really don't have to get to that question of what is, the court doesn't have to decide that question of whether the testimony, says in this case, the various testimony in this case, is not testimony requiring confrontation under Crawford versus Washington, or says whether it is testimony that requires confrontation under Crawford versus Washington, because the trial judge decided that in the Superior Court in his decision.
Well, given that state of the record, why don't you tell us your Teague argument and why the majority of the courts have misconstrued the application of Teague?
The majority of the courts have misconstrued as the application of Teague. Essentially, the right to confrontation, we contend, is a watershed rule of criminal procedure which should be applied retroactively in post-conviction relief, like the right to counsel. It is not the right to counsel, but it is tantamount to the right to counsel. In fact, it's probably more important than the Gideon says right to counsel, because what good is the right to counsel without the right to confrontation? You know, it's essentially a soldier without a rifle, a captain without a ship. For example, if in the Superior Court, because of the trial burdens in a particular week, the judges decided that, my goodness, we can't consider all these cases within this month, within this week, so we're going to have to dispense with this lengthy cross-examination, says, by attorneys, and the witnesses will get what they have to say, and that's it. So we got to squeeze these cases in and get some time. And let's say we had a case where the judges explained to the juries, now you may have seen on television cross-examination. We're not going to do that during this trial, says, or this week or this month. But the attorneys will be there, and the defendant is represented by counsel, so you don't need to be concerned, says, about anything. Just consider the testimony, says, that you hear. Now, let's say, for instance, if the attorney says wasn't slumbering, after the client's own slumber, his appellate period has passed, he then files a post-conviction relief motion and says, hey, this rule violated, says, my right to confrontation, that we weren't allowed to cross-examine, says, the witnesses against us. It was presented on post-conviction relief. Is that not a watershed, says, rule of criminal procedure? How can we not say that confrontation doesn't advance the truth-seeking function, just like the right to counsel? They're inseparable. This is their tantamount. It's not like Shiro versus Summerlin, where Ring was decided to be non-retroactive on post-conviction relief, because it's debatable whether judges are better fact-finders than juries. But how can we say that the truth-seeking function is not advanced by confrontation? We submit it's incomprehensible.
Well, I thought one of the ways it said is that there's a difference between non-testimonial statements and testimonial statements, and that only testimonial statements are subject to the confrontation clause.
Yes. But if...
Well, it would certainly further the truth, theoretically, wouldn't it, if all statements made before trial were absolutely excluded unless they were subject to cross-examination under your theory. But we don't go that far.
Not necessarily, because the constitutional right involves the right to confront, says, the witness's testimony. That's the constitutional right. That's
the limitation. I didn't mean to jump ahead of the question that Justice Holland wanted you to answer, but I assume at some point you're going to discuss the difference in this case between what's characterized as non-testimonial statements and testimonial statements.
Yes. In this case, for instance, all of the testimony in this case was, it was testimony, it was under Crawford. There were no spontaneous declarations.
Well, what about the statements at the school?
The statements at the school? That was questioning, this interrogation by persons. They weren't casual remarks. It was persons searching for answers. It was persons conducting an investigation which they were required to conduct under Delaware law. And if anyone wants to argue they're not, well, they're not police officers, that's a distinction without a difference. If a police officer decides to ignore an investigation like this, it's no crime. It may be dereliction of duty. But if a school teacher or a school nurse fails to interrogate or question a child under suspicious circumstances like this and get to the bottom of it, the truth, they've committed a criminal offense under Delaware law.
Well, is that really the test, or do they become, in effect, under your argument, state agents as a result of that statute?
They're unquestionably state agents. In addition, due to the nature of the testimony, it's formalized testimony.
Well, are they asking the questions, and either whether or they respond to some statement by the purported victim, or whether they ask the question initially based on their observation of an individual being in some distress, are they asking these questions for the purpose of furthering an investigation, or are they asking these questions for the purpose of seeking to protect or find treatment for the individual?
They're both, but they're also seeking to investigate the circumstances to determine what should be done. That's an investigation.
And is there a case law that supports that as qualifying it as testimonial?
Yes, Davis versus Washington and Hammonds versus Indiana, where Justice Scalia described at length the distinction between a description of past events, which is testimony controlled by Crawford, and a contemporaneous recitation of what's going on right now.
Well, let me ask the question a little more specifically. Are there cases where there's a similar statute to ours that requires inquiry and perhaps reporting on the part of a school teacher when a circumstance such as this arises in the school context? And a finding by the highest court of that state, one way or another, on whether the statement to the school teacher is testimonial or non-testimonial?
I'm not aware of that distinction. I know Delaware does. Three cases that I'd like to just point out for the court's consideration, not just Davis versus Washington, Hammonds versus Indiana by the United States Supreme Court, but also what is testimony. Three cases cited in the briefing: Bordeaux versus United States, an Eighth Circuit case; Snowden versus Maryland, a Maryland Supreme Court case; and Bochting versus Bayer itself, which also addressed this identical question, the same issues that the Supreme Court considered under Hammonds versus Indiana, Davis versus Washington, and essentially the same facts that are present in this case. The scenarios are virtually indistinguishable in those three cases vis-a-vis what happened in this case. Insofar as Davis, also, in addition to, I'd like to emphasize that the trial court, who ordinarily would make these determinations based upon constitutional precepts, including Crawford versus Washington, took a look at all the evidence he had previously heard and determined that it would all be affected by Crawford versus Washington. This evidence would not have come in under Crawford versus Washington. But it did come in. So we get to the next question. And insofar as that next question, Davis just alludes to that too. There's a case in Davis, and this is parallels what I attempted to bring out vis-a-vis is the Delaware Constitution, but Davis at page 9 describes in English, as well as at footnote 3 of the case, extensive common law cases in English and early American cases, confrontation-type cases. Davis describes at page 9 an English case in 1779, King versus Brazier. And in that case, a child had reported to her mother that this man did bad things to me and provided detail, etc. It was a neighbor. And in that case, as the court decided, the child could not be sworn because the child was not competent to testify as to these events. Well, that's almost the same thing as saying that the defendant can't confront the witness against him, circumstances identical as to this case, and for that reason, the defendant was discharged. That was the law in 1779 in England. It was probably, says the law, that was adopted common law in this state, and probably the law that was brought along, says under the Delaware versus Constitution. But in 1779, can we picture a situation whereby a child would have reported events to another adult, and an adult could testify to those events, and a court would permit such testimony and sustain a conviction on it? We submit not. And that should be the controlling point of decision, says in this case also. If there's been a question.
Don't we need to focus on whether the retroactivity of Crawford will improve the accuracy of the trial process and the circuits and courts which have looked at it and said it's not retroactive? They said, well, in some cases it will improve the accuracy, but in other cases it won't, because it's excluding evidence that everyone to now has thought has been reliable and admissible. So why is that wrong, that type of analysis?
Then you're bringing the dicta, or the non-controlling precedent of Ohio versus Roberts, back into it. You're substituting a judge's determination for reliability for a jury's opportunity to hear testimony, and they are not proxies under Crawford versus Washington. And we submit the United States Supreme Court as will also determine that. Justice Scalia in Crawford versus Washington was very clear and about and extensively described the foundation of the right to confrontation. It says the tradition which has been reflected in United States jurisprudence, United States Supreme Court jurisprudence, and American law.
I may have missed something, Mr. Adon, because I thought your argument went to the direction of excluding testimony from the jury's hearing, not giving the jury a better opportunity to examine the testimony. I thought the out-of-court statements before the trial that you would characterize as testimonial, the jury would never hear as a result of the rule you advocate us to impose.
Correct.
So how does that broaden the jury's opportunity to examine the facts and have an opportunity to decide who's telling the truth under what circumstances?
Because the benchmark of the accuracy of and the truth-finding function is confrontation, is cross-examination, the greatest engine to discover the truth. It's foundational. It's just as foundational as the right to counsel. What good would counsel be if counsel could not, counsel could, you know, provide advice to a client, do this, do that, but counsel couldn't cross-examine the witnesses against his client at trial, his or her client at trial? And there are telltale signs in the Crawford opinion that Justice Scalia has strong opinions about the, has a strong, there are strong indications that he believes that this right is fundamental, that it is part of the, it is intrinsic to the fact-finding process and advances the discoveries as of truth. And that if we had a situation whereby we just decided, well, counsel, this week or you're not allowed cross-examination, that's just as fundamental as not having counsel. That hinders the truth-finding function just as much as not having counsel. Because in some cases, you know, I've been around since long enough to occasionally see pro se defendants do a better better job of cross-examining witness than counsel just could.
Well, the teacher testifies about the three statements made by the five-year-old child.
Hmm?
And the teacher's cross-examined by counsel about the circumstances under which she or he heard the statements and what the statements might have been, the clarity of the teacher's recollection, all the rest of that, correct?
Mm-hmm.
The only thing counsel doesn't have an opportunity to do was to have been there at the time the statement was made and cross-examined the five-year-old child about what she may have said or not said. And in this particular case, given the circumstances, how effective would that cross-examination have been in any event?
We submit as very effective in that is the meanings of the Crawford decision. That's why Crawford controls that situation and condemns that very scenario. We're not looking at an Ohio versus Roberts judges saying that, oh, well, it's just as good if counsel gets to examine the teacher. No, Crawford doesn't say that. Crawford says that that examination of the complainant concerning testimony, description of past events is necessary. Confrontation.
If I understand your argument correctly, and maybe I'm taking it off tangent, and I apologize if I am, but you're suggesting that counsel could effectively cross-examine a five-year-old mentally retarded child, and that cross-examination would be effective enough to affect the outcome of the trial.
Yes. In this case, the witness didn't even testify. The witness didn't even, wouldn't it be great if the state had that says in every instance, rather than says lay people, says with all their lack of knowledge of courtrooms, says etiquette, says impressions and this and that. The state was able to use professional witnesses like police officers to introduce hearsay so long as we thought it was reliable, says all the time. No, that's not, says what's required. Confrontation requires.
Okay. Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, sir, I would.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the state. Your Honors, if I may begin, certainly the procedural posture of this case is critical to the outcome of this appeal. And obviously there were two trials in this matter, the first of which resulted in a reversal and retrial. After the second trial, Mr. McGriff took a direct appeal to this court, and one of the issues raised specifically was a violation of his right to confront his accuser, this basically challenging the same statements that are at issue here. And this court decided that there was no violation of his Sixth Amendment confrontation rights. And that then brings us to back to Superior Court and the Rule 61 motion for post-conviction relief. And because the issue was previously decided by this court, it was Rule 61(i)(4) that required the motion be denied as formally adjudicated. The only exceptions to Rule 61(i)(4)'s prior adjudication, there's an exception for the interest of justice. Flamer, this court defined interest of justice to mean that the trial court lacked authority to convict or punish. Subsequently, this court went on to define the phrase lacked authority to convict or punish to include errors of constitutional dimension within the main meaning of the United States Supreme Court's decision in Teague v. Lane. So that finally gets us to Teague, and I apologize for going through the dry step-by-step part, but it is fairly critical to the decision here. And before I turn specifically to Teague, although not brought up during oral argument, extensively in the briefs, Mr. McGriff argued that that Crawford was not, in fact, a new rule. And that, at least, just Davis should definitively put that to rest. Crawford is a new rule. The Davis court specifically stated on two separate occasions that Crawford had overruled Ohio v. Roberts when it came to what was testimonial and the requirements for the admission of testimonial statements. So then if I may turn back to Teague, both this court in Flamer and the United States Supreme Court in Teague provided for a general rule of non-retroactivity, and only two exceptions to that rule of non-retroactivity were available. And this is obviously, I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but that only applies after there's been a conviction and the direct appeal has been concluded. And so we certainly procedurally again are at the step where the direct appeal was concluded and Crawford came out after that fact. The first of the two exceptions to Teague's non-retroactivity, instances where a new rule essentially decriminalizes conduct, maybe the simplest way to put it. And Mr. McGriff does not argue, and it's certainly not the case, that Crawford decriminalized any behavior. So the first exception to Teague's non-retroactivity is not applicable to this case. It's then where the rubber meets the road here is the second exception in Teague, the observance of procedures implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. I cannot state that I found something that expressly defines what that concept is. It's not one around which a court can easily get its arms. I think, though, the various circuit courts that have interpreted it generally have come to the conclusion this must be something that improves the reliability of the convictions. And that's where the majority of the circuit courts that have considered retroactivity of Crawford have gone. These courts have, although not all their reasoning is not uniform, but most of them, and I believe there are six or seven circuits at this time that have all found Teague that
Crawford. Well, getting to that analysis, of what a watershed rule is, that's been defined as something that alters our understanding of the bedrock procedural elements that must be found to vitiate the fairness of a particular conviction. And in Crawford itself, the U.S. Supreme Court described the rights that it was affording under that case a bedrock procedural guarantee, the Sixth Amendment. So if you've got bedrock in both of those phrases, why isn't it a watershed rule?
Your Honor, it's not a watershed rule for retroactivity purposes because it does not enhance the reliability of convictions. To apply the Confrontation Clause under these circumstances.
Hypothetically, if all of these statements were excluded under Crawford, could the conviction in this case be upheld?
In this case, it's the state's position that, yes, this court could still uphold the conviction because the vast majority of these statements were non-testimonial.
Well, let me make sure I understand Justice Holland's question and your answer.
Okay.
I think he said if all the statements were excluded. I don't think he made a distinction in his question between testimonial and non-testimonial. I think you reached the next level.
I'm sorry.
Now, if all the statements were excluded, what's your response?
If all these statements are excluded, then that is the evidence against Mr. McGriff, and that would knock out essentially all the evidence, and there would be nothing left. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I tend to lose the point from time to time, and a question helps bring me back,
okay,
much to the consternation of my colleagues.
Well,
not
now,
to mention counsel.
But you know, let's go to the second part, the Chief Justice's follow-up question, which is, you're saying if they were all excluded based on Crawford, are all excluded, period. There'd be no evidence to sustain the conviction. But your fallback argument is going to be, notwithstanding Crawford, some of these statements would have been admissible anyway. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Because statements were non-testimonial.
Well, to make it easy for me, mm-hmm. which ones would not be?
We'll start at the beginning. The statements that I'll just continue to refer to her as VJ, made to her classmates first in the apple orchard, I'll call it incident. She's at her school. She's surrounded by her classmates. There's a dramatic play area set up involving an apple orchard. Part of this scene kind of breaks apart. One child grabs something and strikes another child. And she hears somebody say, you know, so-and-so hit me, to which then she spontaneously states, my daddy hit me, and then goes on to my daddy hit me with his big red stick and begins to point to the areas where she was hurt by her father. Then, in fact, the teacher who's there doesn't question VJ about this. She instead tries to stop her from talking about it in front of the other children. Those statements are not testimonial. And that same scenario is repeated later on in the school year when the same area has been changed from the apple orchard theme to now a housekeeping theme. I don't believe there's another child who's struck by a broom, but the kind of the triggering event to VJ's statement is somebody picking up a broom or something like that. And again, she makes the statements about what her father did to her and again points to the areas where she was harmed.
So every time the child initiated voluntarily a discussion, that is, said something voluntarily without any questioning or prodding by anyone else about this subject, that would be non-testimonial and therefore unaffected by Crawford.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, the third time when she goes into, I'll call this the lunchroom incident, it's a different individual, I believe. She's a speech therapist, a teacher, still a member of the staff, the faculty. VJ sees her in this lunchroom with other teachers. And again, these are five-year-olds, so she just sort of wanders in, and this is not an instance where teachers are offended by a five-year-old coming in. She sits down on the lap of one of these whom she knows and again spontaneously starts talking about, my daddy hit me with his stick, my daddy hit me with his big red stick, and again points. And there's no interrogation by the teachers in the lunchroom in this incident. It's just this kind of free flow of information from VJ to the teachers. Now that then, the teachers were disturbed by this third one, the lunchroom incident, which brings in the record to the fourth incident where the school nurse then is involved. The school nurse calls VJ down to infirmary, if that's the best word to call it, at the school. But essentially, it's the state's position this was not interrogation either. Besides the fact that the school nurse brought VJ down, these were, again, spontaneous statements by VJ to the school nurse. All of the prefatory questions from the nurse to VJ were, you know, how are you doing? You know, how is school going? I'm paraphrasing at this moment, but just general sort of questions, and then how is your family? And then the question asking about the family sparks VJ again spontaneously to relate what her father did to her, again being hurt with the big red stick.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes, absolutely.
I think, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that any time a witness just sort of starts talking about something, about an event, then that qualifies as being non-testimonial because, after all, nobody was interrogating that person and nobody attempted to elicit that information. It just came out of that person's mouth.
That's very close to the state's position. I'm leery to say absolutely any time, but specifically in the case of a five-year-old with her very diminished IQ, there's no rational reason to say that she's going to have forethought beyond that moment. I'm sure I can come up with hypotheticals of situations where somebody might be calculating enough to figure, well, if I just walk up and start blurting out things, maybe we could do an end run on, you know, making this testimonial. But
I don't think too many people are thinking that way, even if mm-hmm. they're not five-year-olds with limited intelligence. But I don't think that that's necessarily the proper standard. Do you draw a distinction between the circumstances where the child was in a play activity or whatever and some event that took place precipitated her reaction, namely, oh, my father hit me with his stick and so forth, as opposed to a situation where the child is being brought into a situation, whether it's the nurse's office or the sexual abuse counselor person, where at that point basically the child is being asked about her life, even if not specifically asked about any abuse. Do you see any room to draw a line between those two different two types of situations?
The state acknowledges the latter scenario involving and what came to be, I guess, the fifth incident in this case where the DFS worker actually went to the school is certainly going to be a closer call. In the state's opening brief, we were able to find one Minnesota intermediate appellate court case that supported the position that even those statements given to the DFS worker in that scenario, where it was clearly more formalized than the spontaneous statements of the first three incidents, the apple orchard, the housekeeping and lunchroom.
And what exception to the hearsay rule do you cite or do you rely on for getting these admitted? And once they're admitted, isn't the state using them for the truth of their content?
Your Honor, I believe that this, at least certainly at the time, they were being admitted under the tender years statute. So I want to say that itself was the mechanism, not another hearsay exception. And that may bring me to another critical point, that even post-Crawford, certainly U.S. Supreme Court has stated how important cross-examination is. That didn't knock out all the existing hearsay exceptions. It simply brought the cross-examination back where it's a testimonial statement. So for all the examples of hearsay that existed at the time the Constitution was adopted, those hearsay exceptions in dying declarations, excited utterance, those have not been eviscerated by Crawford.
Mr. Smith, as I understand it, the distinction that you're trying to make is between testimony that is elicited by questioning, which you appear to concede would fall under Crawford, would be testimonial, and statements that are made voluntarily, spontaneously, without being elicited by anything, correct?
Yes, that's certainly an important distinction.
All right. My question is this. How would that distinction fare under the analysis in Davis versus Washington, that is the opinion by Justice Scalia? Does it survive?
Your Honor, there... I certainly will not say that Davis definitively resolves it. It clearly touches upon it, and there is a footnote that strongly suggests it's not simply going to be, if it's not interrogation, everything's okay. So the state's not trying to make that that point.
Right. One reading of Davis is that if the testimony relates to something, you know, arguable wrongdoing that took place in the past, then that is subject must be subject to cross-examination. On the other hand, if the testimony relates to what is happening now, such as the 9/11, telephone call by someone who's being abused, that's different.
Yes, Your Honor.
So one is in a past versus present analysis versus a spontaneous versus elicited analysis, and I'm wondering how those two fit together, if at all.
Your Honor, I certainly do not disagree with Your Honor's statement of what Davis reached. I believe that's going to the past-present dichotomy is most critical when it's when there's the interrogation. That it's the state's position that given the open-ended question that still is available after Davis, that the present-past dichotomy is not going to be dispositive in the arena of non-interrogation.
So if the child makes statements that are not the product of interrogation, but are made spontaneously, as appeared to have occurred here, you don't get into the Davis analysis. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be the state's position.
Well, help me understand this testimonial distinction you're making with regard to the statute. You seem to say that these statements don't fall within a hearsay exception, but because they're authorized by the statute, then they're no longer testimonial. Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's a fair statement. I don't mean to have passed over some of the questions that you brought up to opposing counsel regarding the fact that Bochting is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. The state has no objection to this court waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule in Bochting, but it would be the state's preference that this court decide the case within its normal time frames.
Well, let me follow up on that. If I understand correctly, you're saying that even if Crawford is held to be retroactive, it won't affect this case because Crawford doesn't apply.
That's
even
correct,
even if retroactive, that the evidence that was used in this case was not evidence that was that would have been disallowed under Crawford.
Yes, Your Honor.
I had asked you earlier what part of the testimony that was admitted would you agree was testimonial and perhaps should not be admitted? And then the follow-up to that, of course, is how does a harmless error analysis play on that?
Certainly the statements that are arguably closest to testimonial would be once the DFS worker was involved and presented the pictures to VJ. It's the state's position that that testimony would still be subject to harmless error analysis because, in fact, it did not add anything to the existing state of the case. The other four incidents provided precisely the same information. There was in fact no more detail given with the testimony of the DFS worker than with the other incidents. So therefore, this court could say even if that had not come in, it's harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt because that testimony was effectively cumulative.
And that's the only instance that you believe we might find that it was testimonial evidence that was admitted in error?
Yes, Your Honor.
To follow up on the Chief Justice's question, what does the record show as to whether or not the child was sexually penetrated?
Your Honor, the record does not show evidence either for or against, because of the fact of the substantial delay in the reporting. There's no medical evidence conclusively one way or another. See that my yellow light is on. Therefore, the state would request that this court affirm the decision of the Superior Court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
The state contends that Crawford is not a new rule. I didn't address that in my opening remarks. However, we did address it at some length in the briefing, and we're not conceding says that argument at all. The state points out that Davis says it's a new rule. We submit Davis really doesn't say that. There's dicta in that suggests that, but that may be decided differently when the Supreme Court decides Wharton versus Bochting, and we submit that it will. In addition, Crawford really overruled the dicta in Ohio versus Roberts. It didn't really overrule the holding in Ohio versus Roberts, which Justice Scalia made clear, says in the opinion.
So what do you think is left of trustworthy and reliability?
Nothing. I intend to address that insofar as the state argued that in a moment. The decisions not apply. There were decisions not – the court – Your Honor referred to courts, various courts, not applying Crawford's as retroactively, a number of circuit courts and state courts. I'd like to point out that most of those courts did not consider Roberts versus Russell, a United States Supreme Court decision that applied Bruton retroactively. Bruton was a confrontation case where confrontation was denied, says completely. The United States Supreme Court essentially recognized it in Roberts versus Russell as really a bedrock procedural guarantee and applied Bruton retroactively. Most of the courts that have held that Crawford is not retroactive have not considered as Roberts versus Russell at all. The state argues that
if we repealed the rule of evidence that the catch-all at the end of the hearsay rule that says if otherwise indicia of reliability. If we repealed that as a court, that would make that rule different, wouldn't it? It would be a new rule, right?
The procedural rule allowing the admission of this evidence?
That's right. It would no longer be admissible. So that would be a new rule.
Correct. If it's unconstitutional, it's no longer admissible under
the... Well, setting aside the constitutional issue, if we did it to the rules of evidence, that would make that rule differently, and it would be considered...
Well, I'm not sure the court can do that since the 10-year use exception is a statute, but that's a whole other area. I happen to believe that it says really the legislature can't make procedural rules for the court. It's a violation of the separation of powers, but we don't – are not addressing that here. No, that's dicta. Insofar as the child not initiating the statements, et cetera, therefore it should be considered – what if I went back to Officer so-and-so and reported that Mr. Smith did this, this, and that? Now, I didn't initiate it. He didn't interrogate me. But would Mr. Smith be shocked if Officer so-and-so could testify against him in court without me being, says, the witness he could confront? That's not – all this stuff about the reliability of the child statement, it's a proxy for reliability. It's not permitted by Crawford. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.